Backseat Book Club, interview with T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne.
This is Lena.
This is Scott.
And we are the Backseat Producers. You're listening to Backseat Book Club, and we have as very special guests T. Morris and Pip Ballantyne, authors of our book number 4, A Phoenix Rising, A Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences book. Thank you so much for joining us, T and Pip.
Good to be
here. It is a pleasure.
We are thrilled to have you here. I will start off by saying that this was my first foray into steampunk. I knew very little about it. And I thought it was a really good introduction. I have no idea if other steampunk, if it gets grittier or, I don't know, more confusing.
Well, I'm sure these guys are the experts, but I'm the guy who's like, I enjoy steampunk. Still not a genre.
Well, you know, it's like steampunk comes in many flavors. There's romantic steampunk. There is
erotic
steampunk. There is
fantasy steampunk.
Dystopian steampunk. There's all kinds of steampunk. And while within the subgenre of steampunk, they are trying to divvy it into even smaller genres like diesel punk, clock punk,
sandal punk.
I mean,
sail punk.
Just some.
Tesla punk. If you call it atomic punk, I will punch you because it's been Raygun Gothic for decades now. Not everything is a punk.
It seems a wee bit of overkill to me. No, not
no,
you.
I
meant all
the
different. I mean, you, yes, but.
Punk.
And for the record, I won't.
Well, I believe in nothing.
that is your middle name.
Well, I was going to say, Elena, and for the record, I won't let him punch anybody. You have to come out. I got to deal with him on a regular basis here. I have to listen to his rants on a regular basis.
That's why we like you so much, because we know what you have to put up with. breaking down steampunk into just keep breaking it down and breaking it down. It seems like overkill to me.
It is. And is that it's science fiction set in the Victorian age, but taken one step further.
Mm-hmm.
What Savage's reference engine had caught on, instead of it being just a cute trinket, what if it was actually something that started appearing in his homes? What if Babbage had actually created the analytical engine that he had plans for? There are all these...
And Ed's airships.
And Ed's... No, airships were already there, but they take the ships and they advance them. They advance the airship technology.
Yes.
And there are all these little subtle nuances and stuff. Well, you can either make it a commentary about the Victorian and Edwardian society, or you can do what Pip and I had and
just have fun with it.
Just have a blast with it.
I'm really glad that, you know, for my introduction into steampunk, it was this book. I know there's tons out there, and I kept thinking about, you know, just starting with something free on my Nook just to kind of get my feet wet, but. I really did want to start with your book, and I'm glad I did. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Glad to.
Because to us, you're the target audience. When people say this is the way steampunk should be done, we're flattered by that. But we really want the Ministry of Occurrences series to be a breakthrough series, breakout series. We want to be that series that people pick up. They've never picked up steampunk before. This is blatantly steampunk. You pick it up and you're like, okay, I know what I'm just by looking at the cover. And then you wind up going, oh, wow, that's steampunk. I get it now. Now, granted, when the steampunk fans, gush over our books, that's also very cool. We did well, but always nice when we hear people that either don't steampunk, Tony Mast, or
I read his review. I remember that.
And for people who have never read steampunk, if we're your gateway drug, fantastic. After you finish with us, I suggest go out and get Battle of Blood and Ink, A Fable of the Flying City by Jared Axelrod and Steve Walker. You won't be sorry.
Okay. Yeah, actually, I need to read your second book first. That's...
Read it. Sorry, Jared. Oh.
I will read yours first.
CT, you're slipping here. You need to tell people that, well, next year we should read the second book. Keep that marketing machine going.
Now, is there a third book in the works, or?
Well, it's handed in at the end of last year to the new publishers who are going to be doing. They've two more books, so 3 and 4 are confirmed. And we haven't yet got a publication date on it. We're still waiting to see what slots open up. We're hoping at the end of this year, maybe the worst case scenario. So, yeah, in between the fourth book, and we're also working on a bunch of other little side projects with the minister. Going to keep it occupied.
Cool. Sam, yeah, have something you want to ask?
So my question to you guys is, what do you feel makes the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences so much more of a gateway drug than, say, something like Bone Shaker by Sherry Priest?
I believe that if you were to pick up steampunk, if you were to pick up Sherry Priest and read some of the stuff in Bone Shaker, you'd be like, What is this deep?
There's a bit more of a horror element to it as well.
Yeah.
You have some horrible things, but yeah.
That's the part that I always loved about both our books, is that they're light and they're fun. Then they take a serious curve that nobody sees coming. And to me, that's what really comedy should do. It should make you laugh. It should make you just have your sides hurting from how funny stuff is. And then suddenly it turns corner and it gets really dark. But if you're from beginning to end, I think that can be a lot to take in.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I jumped from Ministry to Bone Shaker, and that was before the Janus Affair came out. And I just remember going from this really quirky tone to this really almost historical horror novel in some cases. And my brain was just...
Remembering, of course, that the thing she read prior to that would have been Perdido Street Station.
Oh, yeah.
So, little bit of whiplash.
So, for me, it was just... I really do enjoy a more whimsical tone in things that I read. As much as I love the serious tone that a lot of people do for steampunk, I do think it is a... And Scott, you can yell at me later, genre that deserves to have a little bit more quirk and a little bit more humor to really fully appreciate.
It is attached to another genre. I will not relent from this position.
Honey, I will beat you up later.
Well, Carrigan's Parasol Protectorate series are full of whimsy.
I love that series too.
I mean, there's plenty of room in steampunk for both the whimsical and the dark and gritty. And I think that's the fun of the genre, is that you can have both and both be steampunk.
What got the two of you into steampunk? Was it, you know, like, did you kind of run across something reading, or from another author? Or?
Actually, more of a visual thing for me. We dedicated the first book to Jared Axelrod and J.R. Blackwell. And the thing is, JR is a very talented photographer. Jared is an incredible maker, and they were doing some steampunk shots at one time. And
Jared Axelrod, if you go to Wikipedia, Jared Axelrod's face is the first thing you see.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
And it's a pretty impressive looking outfit and things like that. And I remember this is when I was getting to know them, and I said, "What is this? This look?" And that was when they told me it was steampunk. So I started doing more and more research.
Mm-hmm.
Steampunk was. I noticed it starting to crop up more and more at conventions. So I wanted to write in the, I knew I wanted to write in the genre. And while many steampunks really just kind of throw their hands up when I say this, another thing that was a gateway drug for me was the movie The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which, while far from a perfect movie, I enjoyed it for what it was. I enjoyed it. I was able to look past its faults. It is not a movie that I would go out of my way to watch, but it is a movie that I enjoy in small doses. And I wanted to write something like that. I wanted to write something fun, but I didn't want it to have the suck that the movie had. So I was toying around with ideas, and now I'm going to segue over to how Pip got involved.
Well, I first of all liked the history. I mean, I wrote books, and T did as well. Like Tudor. But T and I were just discussing the whole podcasting for pay thing back in 2009. And that's when I thought T was talking to me about his idea for this thing called the Ministry. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. So why don't we do that for podcast for pay? And then it accidentally turned into a novel. Whoops.
Which I'm sure is still probably the more lucrative option, considering all 35 of my dollars I've made podcasting.
I must say, when somebody said, hey, could this be a book? Yes.
Pivot put an announcement on her blog that she was working on a project, and she didn't even say what it was, just a steampunk project with author T. Morris. And her agent contacted her, said, Pip, I just had an editor call me. They visited your website and they saw that you had a steampunk project in the works. Tell me more about it. How far are you?
And Pip was, cool.
10,000 words, maybe?
10,000 words. Great. Can you get me a synopsis or proposal and this put together and we can start pitching it? Pip was like, well, and she thought she was going to buy some time by saying, well, you're going to have to pick up T because T's part of this too. Okay, fine. We'll sign him on. And then next thing I knew, I was starting a brand new job, and during parts of the work day, I was like looking over my shoulder, then hammering out like a paragraph at a time, part of the synopsis, and so I could make sure that we could get it out in time.
But luckily, the Ministry books are pretty easy to write, so they're fun.
Oh no, they're a blast to write. They're a blast.
How do you? Most of my questions is just personal curiosity. How do you write collaboratively? Is it back and forth, or do you really kind of sit down together and work out a story and figure it all out?
Well, we started off pretty simply that T was going to write Wellington's character and I was going to write Eliza. Mm-hmm. And then along the way, we ended up with interludes with different characters, which seem to be whoever gets to them first writes them. And then
sometimes we have to wrestle it. Wrestle it. Like, yeah. No, I want to write that. No,
But then whatever we're writing, we hand it over to the other person and they edit it and add their own little bits into it or cut bits out. And so it's evolved into kind of an organic process. And when we do the dialogue, we sit down and shoot the breeze and write it down and go, oh, yeah, that'd be cool for
yeah,
us.
Exactly.
Often the dialogue is some of the most fun bits to write.
Yeah.
I loved the chemistry between the two of them. I thought was fantastic, and I literally thought of the two of you in those characters as I read the book.
We've heard that a lot.
Banter. It's called professional talking.
Like the banter between the two of them, and it's always nice when I hear someone compare us to moonlighting, which goes but I mean, you know, those early episodes of moonlighting between Bruce Willis and Sybil Shepherd, I mean, that's modern day Shakespeare right there.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a kick out of that comparison. I got a kick out of it when I hear people say, yeah, it reminds me of the 1960s BBC Avengers. And I'm like, yes, it should. Yes.
Well, that the hat kind of gives that one away.
Well, I also like the other embarrassment. It's James Bond in a corset. Mm-hmm. It's part James Bond, part the Odd Couple.
And it just furthers my
our podcast kind of in the episode settled on Lethal Weapon because it always struck me that Wellington is just too old for this shit.
No, the difference is that Danny Glover's character in Lethal Weapon just tended to bitch. He just bitched and whinged and moaned and the problem with the rigs. The other problem is you got Mel Gibson's character. I don't ever. Taking a gun, putting it in her mouth, you know, threatening to shoot herself in front of books. It just never happened. So, neat analogy. It's a neat analogy, but there were several times Eliza wanted to shoot Wellington, but that's an entirely different. That's entirely
there's
different.
There's definitely a bit of there in there as well. It's sort of antagonistic, but you know that they care about each other kind of relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
And I will say that the end of the book, I was properly teased. I was pissed off. I was like, what? No. I want the rest now. It was a very good way to tease because there was so much you left dangling for me.
We had two books, at least two books in the series, right. So we weren't going to be cruel enough to. Although when I wrote my other series, my fantasy series, Geist and Spectre, I only had a book deal. I wrote the end of the second book to be this huge cliffhanger. And I was like, yeah, they better get me some more books.
All right. Well, actually, I wouldn't describe it as a writer's trick. It's more like it's like your James Bond table. With Sharif on the other side, and you're basically saying, you know, you're even those dangling participles there, so that the editor was like, if the editor really digs the book, they'll be like,
I gotta find out.
Wait. It's like, well, it's going to cost you. Fine, here's another duplicate contract. If the editor just goes, yeah, this is great, you're like, oh crap.
Oh no! But in this day and age, I mean, the worst case scenario, you write the book and you self-publish it.
I mean, so much has changed in the industry just between the time of us signing the contract for Rising and signing the contract for Dawn's Earth, like, it's been amazing to watch. It's been amazing to watch.
I've been talking a lot. It's very unlike me.
Well, yeah, you were rolling. I was going to let you. I've not consumed enough stout to be sufficiently gregarious to really run this thing.
Oh, I got a question.
Far away.
What are some of the difficulties you guys face when doing co-writing?
The biggest difficulty that we is we think it's a brilliant idea, and then we think that one of us has written it down, and we haven't.
Etty, what you're talking about, I did write it.
And I'm saying now we learned our lessons with the Janus Affair. And so for Dawn's Early Light, anytime we have an idea, we just say, write it down. If you have an iPad, type it out. But we're better at that. I mean,
I think the worst thing is when we go and kill characters and we disagree about it and we have to come up with reasons why they shouldn't, you know,
that's
no,
true.
They should not
true.
Die.
They should not. Well, there's a lot. Now that's also kind of a funny story was that we will sometimes get characters to do things, and if it's something that's against something we believe in passionately, no, they can't do that. But it works the story. No, the example I'm talking about.
Oh, I know what you're gonna say.
Yeah, you know the story. In the Janus Affair, we have a rugby game.
Don't give away too much.
I'm not gonna give anything away, but basically,
I don't think rugby is much of a spoiler.
yeah, but in the rugby.
Also. You know what? Throwing it down. Spoiler warning.
Spoiler! All right, fine.
Spoiler. Spoiler warning. Paddington is playing rugby, and he breaks the rules, basically someone a lesson. And she looks at me with this abject terror in her face, and she says, "That's an illegal hit.
He wouldn't do that."
Breaking to impress A and show up B. No, but he's breaking the rules. I'm like, yes, he's doing it. It's called a character flaw. No, T, you don't understand. When New Zealand players play rugby, they play as a passion, as a dignity. And I'm looking at her.
Well, luckily, Wellington's not from New Zealand.
Though. Exactly. I was like, well, Wellington's not from New Zealand. No, you don't understand. Let it go. No, let it go, baby.
What about when I tried to kill a character and I tried to save them?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, you can't do that, honey.
I want them to live.
Damn. They're dead from a great height. They could flip it and flip out through this and do X, Y, Z. And I'm looking at her like, did we stop writing steampunk and start writing Marvel comics? Okay. But Widow, okay, she's not Hawkeye, she's not Iron Man.
I did save a character in the fourth book. Though.
You did save a character in the fourth book. So give her that much.
Yay!
So it's just a thing. It comes down. Has got the
for books and brawn. How did you kind of? I'm trying to think of how to phrase this without sounding really silly. Are parts of them parts of you? Are they, or is it, you know, are there parts that you kind of wish you could be, or?
Kaiser is, well, she's from New Zealand, so we've got that in common.
Yeah.
Indeed.
She's very spirited, which is common.
Yes. But she's a lot more, less considered about things than I am, which I think in books is fun, but I think in real life perhaps she could get into a lot of trouble. But yeah, I mean, in any character, there's always a little bit of you in them, some mm-hmm. of you. I don't know. What are you like, Wellington?
I feel like Wellington Books is an idealized version of myself. I mean, I wish I
was not Mary suing it, eh?
No, I don't think I'm not Mary suing it, because Wellington can flip out with...
Well, nothing goes his way, for starters.
Well, no.
You get more girls.
It's not that nothing goes his way. It's that Wellington doesn't take, or at least he tries not to take chances. And funny thing is that in a podcast, we explore exactly why he does that.
Nah.
You know, it's funny because in both Phoenix Rising and the Janus Affair, you take a journey into Wellington Books, and by the end of the second book, he realizes maybe it's okay to start taking chances again. And then in the third book, he kind of has to hang on to that. And so with Wellington, I mean, I put in aspects of myself that I think are there. But at the same time, I wish I was as intelligent, as whip smart, as well read as Wellington is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not as well read as I'd like to be, but I'm getting there. And you know, I do. I think Wellington, he's a guy that I would be mates with. I'd definitely be friends with. I just have to, you know, be patient and understand. Okay, he's not a risk taker.
Well, we're coming to think of that. I actually, he's made me think. I had a friend when I was at high school that always got me into trouble. I think that would be Eliza. She would be the friend that is always going, come on, let's climb out this window and shimmy down this pipe. And yeah, and I'd be the one getting in trouble.
Because she would have done it already and hid.
And she'd do it far better.
Exactly.
Okay, so here's one for me: is how much world building did you go into this doing beforehand? Because, you know, obviously there are some lesser steampunk authors who are just like, well, Victorian England, let's slap some goggles on it, versus, you know, actually thinking through the exact tech. How much do you feel you did beforehand, and how much did you do as you were going on?
Oh, quite a bit of time period and stuff. I said New Zealand suffragette movement plays into that. Wanted the tech to be integrated into it rather than, you know, that.
Just glue some gears on it. So at this steampunk project we were working on, we met the guy. we met the guy that did. Very charming fellow.
But we wanted our technology to be more than just surface stuff. People use it in their everyday life. The first book we have the globular bar that
we had
a lot of fun.
We wanted to make the tech. What the other thing too is we wanted tech. We wanted to make the tech the part of the like we said earlier, part of the lifestyle, not just something that the privileged few would have. We wanted it to be like the Apple or the Windows of the day, and so things would malfunction. Things might work. Things might not work.
Have you tried turning it off and turning it on again?
Are your boilers full?
Try pouring in water and pouring it out again. I mean, the other thing too, and that's part of what made writing steampunk for me so entertaining and so much fun is, okay, if there was something invented, how would it affect, say, art? How would it affect music? How would it affect just the way people got by? And that opened up doors for a lot of possibilities, a lot of side moments that you saw the effect of that technology. You know, how did the exhibition hall look? Moving statues, change of artwork, that kind of thing. And it was, and even the weapons. I don't know. In other steampunk, you hear people talk about the weapons or describe the weapons, but you never find out like the science behind them. And you'll notice that in some of the sidearms that we mention in our books, there's usually a second or a third person associated with a name you might recognize, like the Wembley. Enheiser, Mark II, and you're like, well, who's Enheiser? And you find out, and if you look him up, you find out he was an engineer. And so we had a weaponsmith and an engineer collaborating to make a steampunk weapon, which stands to reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me was part of what I wanted our steampunk to be. That we not only thought about the tech, but what the effect that technology would have on society.
Okay, and so how much research did you feel you had to do to really accomplish everything you wanted? Like, I did notice you went out of your way to justify Eliza wearing a pair of jeans in book two.
Well, that's the fun bit, really, is finding out those sort of things. And when you dig into history, you actually find out a lot of stuff. In the second book, for example, the suffragette movement had trained women in a martial art specifically to fight off the predations of the police. And so we're like, oh, that is so awesome. We've got to put that in. And so we ended up with a group we called the Protectors, who were modeled directly after actual history. So that when you look into those sort of things, it does feed directly back into the creative process as well.
Yeah, the hard part too is trying not to show off what you find out.
Yeah.
Currently, right now, I'm reading 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I'm enjoying parts of it. But I tell you something, Jules Verne should have called this book "How Much I Know About Fish," because I have learned more about fish in this freaking book. And I don't remember James Mason, you know, right before he took out a ship saying something like,
"Oh, look at that fish over
before
there.
We go into this, Professor Aronnax, I want to tell you about the cetaceous Corpulaeus. It's floating out there. I want you to go look at it. Now I'm going up to the control room and having a psychotic episode."
Well, I think he may have been trying to one-up Herman Melville's epic How Much I've Learned About the Whaling Industry.
No kidding. But I mean, but again.
But that, when you think about it, in those time periods, you were reading and you might also want to teach people something because,
right,
you know
right.
That's different.
It was a story for a book of its age. But for like for us, I mean, we want to make sure that if, you know, we mentioned that, yes, you know, we don't necessarily out of our way to explain blue jeans, but we wanted to make sure that history Nazis go, oh, blah, 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 blah. We go, if you look here, blah, 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 F you. And
I have to bring one history point that comes out in the Janus affair, which is this is my favorite. Somebody on the blog was talking about a famous music suffragette, Kate Shepherd, in the second book. And she did actually have a son called Douglas. And actually, at the time where we wrote the book, he would have been 14. And somebody wrote, they were like, well, you know, Douglas Shepherd would have at this time, because I didn't write back to them, but I, so we made him older. It's called steampunk. It's not. It's an old history.
And that's the other thing too, that the history Nazis that come in and they read Phoenix Rising or they read the Janus Affair and they go, I would hardly describe this as a historically accurate novel. And I say, well, what was?
Wasn't there a secret base in the Antarctic in the first one?
You know, was it the secret base in Antarctica or the secret society called the House of Usher? I mean,
we didn't
really,
try and hide it.
Really.
But yeah. So I mean, history should inform the creation, but you shouldn't go, I mean, crazy. That you've got to service the plot and the characters as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're trying to show off what you know and what you search, then you're wrong. It's got to be about the story first.
100 years too late.
Exactly.
When kind of getting back to the two of you, when you both started writing, did you start off? I mean, was sci-fi what you guys were into, or did you start writing other things? Or
yeah, I've always wanted to write science fiction and fantasy. I've always had a thing for it ever since I was a kid, and I'm still a kid. I mean, I do. I genuinely enjoy the genre. I genuinely enjoy the different facets of the genre: science fiction, fantasy, horror, the subgenres.
Speculative fiction.
No, it's
speculative fiction.
I find it pretentious when I hear people say, I do not write science fiction fantasy. I write speculative fiction.
You can't even get Margaret Atwood to go that far, though.
Well, you know, Michael Crichton, I don't write science fiction. Like, really? You got people time traveling, you know, a giant fax machine, and you're telling me you don't bringing back source through DNA that's been pulled out of a small thing of amber, and you're telling me you don't write science fiction? Okay.
Hey, no, right? Michael Crichton has 10 pages of work cited at the end of his novels. That can't be all science fiction.
This coming from the born Christian. This is the same mentality as the idiots who call the Da Vinci Code a non-fiction book. And I've met them, and I've looked at them like they are complete morons. I mean, getting back to the question, yes, I've always written science fiction.
Too. I mean,
where'd that soapbox come from? Jeez.
I don't know. We'll kick it out. Science fiction and fantasy all the way. My dad read me Lord of the Rings as a bedtime story when I was 8, and I blame him for everything.
Oh, actually, speaking of Lord of the Rings and New Zealand, what is your stance on this whole Pavlova issue?
What's the Pavlova issue? What am I?
Well, it is a dessert claimed by both New Zealand and Australia.
Oh, okay. I didn't know there was bad blood.
The ownership of the dessert is disputed.
Ah,
book 1921. We have the documentary evidence. So I'm sorry, Australia. You came. That's all to be said.
All I know is that it's delicious and I can make one.
It's good. Chocolate pavlova is also very good.
A chocolate one?
Chocolate pavlovas.
I've never made a chocolate one. Oh. Got to add that to my list.
I'm trying to think. I'm trying very hard not to sit here and fangirl. I'm not going to lie. That's why I've been staying very quiet.
Sam, you're allowed to fangirl for 2 minutes starting now.
No, I'm very shy.
Just a little bit of fangirl isn't a bad thing.
Okay. Tip, I really love your smut.
I've been waiting for that.
Oh, good. This year I'm bringing the smut back. I went by age, but now I've recharged smut-wise, and I'm coming.
I want to read your smut.
You should read her smut. It's so good.
I didn't know you had smut.
Yeah, Pitbull smut. It's like 50 Shades of Grey, but doesn't suck.
Excellent.
This is why, Lena, you need to read
Geist.
No,
I'm pretty sure there was sucking in 50 Shades of Grey around page 37.
Oh, Scott.
Tish.
Oh, so happy trails and Pip smut.
No.
I have written smut for Pip.
That's right. The podcast you're talking about is eroticaalacarte.com, which is... And in between writing steampunk. Yeah, I wrote some steampunk smut.
Yep.
Cool. I shall check this out.
It's been on hiatus, but it's coming back.
Sexy times.
Yeah, what was really interesting about Pip's arc was that the first few episodes were timid. They were slightly timid.
Well, the reason I started Erotica a la Carte is because I couldn't write a sex to save my life. I got too embarrassed and I shut the door on the characters. I was like, you know what? Is it right? If I need to go there, I want to be able to go there. So I'm going to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it was around story 4 or 5. Maybe she let loose. Well, tentacle <it's>... porn.
Woo-hoo.
Who doesn't like that? I mean, it's a fun genre. And slightly steampunkish. Tentacles are very steampunk.
Not in this one.
My brain suddenly went to a bad place.
It's supposed to.
I know.
That's the point.
Tentacles!
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the spot.
Scott, you may now throw some water
sure
on
to
Sam.
Make sure that happens. Well, I guess I have to ask this. Is what do we have in store for book 3 then? Can you tease us?
Is there tentacles?
Is it too late to add tentacles?
Yes. Book 4 might have tentacles. I'm actually working on a story that could also have tentacles. So there's
that. Book 3 is Books and Brawn in America.
Oh, that's nifty.
The
agents of
Awesome, OSM, the Office of the Supernatural and Metaphysical,
mm-hmm.
and investigating strange shipwrecks and disappearances off the coast of the Outer Banks of North Carolina.
But it ends up in a cross-continental romp.
Then it becomes a cross-continental romp. We take up to Flagstaff. Flagstaff, Arizona, or at that time, the Arizona Territories.
Mm-hmm.
And then we end up in San Francisco.
Mm.
So let's see, what else have we got? Let's see, we get extended scenes with R&D. We meet the scientist Axelrod and Blackwell.
Sophia shows up,
and they bring in an independent contractor, Nikolai Tesla.
Because wouldn't doubt, just add Tesla.
He's not the guy necessarily that you want to, with all the quirks he's got going for him. He's not a. Like trust to quote unquote get the job done.
If it was in a firefight, all you would need to do and to set him opposite him is a woman wearing pearl necklace.
There you go.
And he'd run screaming.
See,
although we should build him like a steam powered pigeon trans.
No. No.
Well, I'm sure Matt Fraction wouldn't mind if you gave him the giant robot suit from Five Fists of Science.
Yes, but we do have Tesla, and of course Edison shows up, because you can't have Tesla without Edison.
And finally, what else can we tell you about the story? Yes, the Maestro. You find out more about the Maestro in this episode.
We find out a bit more about him in the Janus Affair.
Yes.
And then you find out a bit more in the third. And ta-da then, in the fourth.
And then in the fourth, it's on like Donkey Kong.
Donkey Kong.
I'm pretty sure you could have, well, in that case, I think you may have to have some sort of like a clockwork powered version of Donkey Kong appear.
Now, T, you said you were reading 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
Yes.
What are you reading now, Pip? What's on your nightstand?
It's coming out. I blurbed it for somebody, and it's really cool. It's steampunk. It's got Sherlock Holmes in it. It's got Sherlock Holmes's niece. And I think it's coming out the middle of this year. And it's a delightful, fun, whimsical, clever book. Enjoyed it.
Very good. For both of you, are there any particular authors that you know you find specific, you know, just personally like very inspiring to you?
Well, my personal heroine is Jay Cherry, who writes all sorts of different science fiction and fantasy novels. Of Morgaine and all of that. She's not only does she write really amazing works, but she's had a very long, diverse career, which is kind of like I aspire to be. So she's up there. What about you, Morris?
Terry Brooks.
I knew you were going to say that. I could have answered for him.
Yeah, Terry Brooks. Just not only is he an extremely prolific writer. Extremely talented writer. He's just a good guy. He's a really, really good guy, and I can't say a bad thing about him. And he inspired me to do this. He's always been, you know, he's been a source of inspiration for years. And it was a few years ago, I had my photograph taken with Terry Brooks on one side of me, and on the other side of me was the 10th grade English teacher. That also encouraged me to write, and it was the first thing I ever seriously wrote and somebody else read.
Wow.
And when I saw that photograph, I took a step back and I was like, okay, that was a moment. And so yeah, Terry Brooks, bar none.
Now I have a question, and if I'm venturing into too personal information, I'll just cut this out. Do you find that you're it's kind of a casual question about your daughter. Since you're both writers, do you find that she is developing any kind of passion for it, for writing?
Definitely got the imagination of a writer.
Yes.
And she's mad keen on dragons right now.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
She thinks it's cool. My book coming in, Kindred and Wings, has got, I've shown her the pictures, there's a dragon on the front of it. So
she even had an effect. She had a say in how the cover, what the final cover looked.
That's right. Yeah, got the cover of Kindred and Wings. You know, the advanced copy, and she looked at it and she said, "I don't think the nose is quite right." So back and they changed it. So yeah, I mean, she used to, like a couple of years ago. She was like, "Writing's boring." Hey, what would it be like if we had like a party with all dragons and they all arrived and we couldn't fit them in the house? I'm like, child, you are skirting dangerously close to being a writer.
Yeah, she could be.
I think that's cool. I mean, I don't know if it just fills the two of you with immense pride or maybe a little dread. Maybe a little both.
Interesting. By the time she's, you know, grown up and stuff enough to venture into trying to make money out of writing, who knows what it'll look like, the publishing world. Yes. Maybe telling stories to each other's brains.
But I would impress upon her that writing is a skill, whether it's for fun, whether you do it for passion, whether you do it have to. Being well read is just being well written is just as important as being well read.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I want to make sure that she feels that it's not a bad thing to be smart and that it's a bad thing to be well written. It really is a skill, and it can only benefit you in life. I mean, when I'm not writing the stuff, the science fiction and the steampunk and the fantasy, I try to blog as much as I can. And right now I am blogging for for my day job. I'm blogging for a green blog. I am blogging about the experience of embarking on the electric car lifestyle. You know, what's it like electric? Into that, it's really a lot of fun. And I know that part of the reason why my blog posts are favorites over here is because I can write. It's a skill that everyone can have.
Yeah.
Yep. Have you two done any other or plan on doing any other collaborative books that aren't Books and Brawn?
We haven't really talked about it. I think once I start putting out a couple of solo novels, I think I will probably feel better about saying, "Hey, what's the thing we should do next?"
I think I'd rather wait until the ministry reaches whatever conclusion it reaches, whether we get another couple of books out of it, another couple of book deals, or whatever. It's fun to do projects with him, but don't tell him that. And
my lips are sealed.
Once
the ministry is finished, I think I'd be quite happy to do another project. I don't know if I'd start another one while we're still going. See how it goes. It's nice to have your own stuff as well as the stuff together, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I just have to finish my solo novel. Once I get that done, then okay. Then it's like, let's talk a little bit about what we want to do next, you know. And I'm sure we've got something in us. We just haven't. We're having what's wrong with the ministry right now.
Excellent. Scott, I've gone through my everything I've been jotting down for the past couple of days. I've gone through them.
So obviously, when you are, what do you guys do when you aren't writing? Like, what is the one thing that you never get to talk about that you love doing, but with your time off?
I like watching movies, but we haven't been able to watch many lately.
We haven't been able to, yeah. It's been kind of frustrating because we still have the Blu-ray of the Avengers.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still in that shrink wrap. I mean, what's up with that? I think one of the things that we've been doing lately, though, that's been really fun, has been introducing our daughter to Doctor Who. And it happened completely by accident. I was on the elliptical. I was, you know, doing, and just started The Doctor, The Widow, and The Wardrobe. And Sonic Boom comes downstairs, and she stops and looks at the TV and looks at me and goes, "What you watching, Dad?" And I said, "I'm watching Doctor Who." And she says, "Why does that man have a spacesuit on backwards?" And I said, "That part, honey, but it's a little complicated." She said, "Can I watch?" Now, Doctor Who can be intense. And I said, "Well, sure.
Let's try,
see what happens." At the end of the episode, she turns to both of us and says,
"Can I
watch another one?"
This is a geeky dream come true.
This is a geek dream. So go back, not all the way back, but we're
not back
to
the 1960s.
But we're going to go and work our way through. And it has reached a point now where we have to set aside 4 hours out of the day for that talk of Who.
Wow.
And
I thought she would be scared by the empty child, because I'm scared by the empty child.
My mommy.
Yeah.
Mommy. Ready in, mommy. And, she was digging it. She was, and she still digs it. In fact, she has her own sonic screwdriver now, and she has it. It's interesting. She has that right by her bed, and then she also has her wand by her bed.
Harry Potter,
Hermione's wand, and then she has like usually a Skylander by the bed, and they have to be in a specific order,
just in case.
In case you know, Harry shit gets real.
Up. Yeah,
you know.
Just in case. Yeah, introducing her to geeky stuff, and we took her on the steampunk shoot as well. But traveling, we haven't really done much traveling apart from going to conventions and stuff.
There's that. And I mean, one of the other things that I know that I genuinely enjoy doing is I know it's related to the writing, but I genuinely enjoy podcasting. But between podcasting and writing, like first. And sometimes that means the podcasting
has to slip a little.
Mm-hmm. We have our own podcast. It's called The Shared Desk. It's at theshareddesk.com. And we love doing it because we fire up the mics and we just let it fly.
It's beautiful because we don't have to edit it very much.
Not really. And we just enjoy it for what it is. But we haven't been able to do that lately because of some of the other things that have been cropping up here and there. So yeah, I those are the things I think we tend to do, and in a pinch we'll say, okay, let's at least set aside some time for a movie, like an old classic movie like North by Northwest or something like that. But the thing about the writer's lifestyle is that it can get hard to squeeze in that
especially with deadlines. A lot of deadlines last year,
and you're marketing other while you're doing that, and then you're for the next book. But you do need to schedule that downtime for yourself, because if you don't, you're just gonna burn out.
And the conventions, what is the most fun part of conventions for you?
Oh, that's easy.
Meeting readers and listeners.
Yeah.
So we were in Emerald City Steampunk Expo, which was in Wichita, Kansas, and we got our very first play of one of our characters. We had a lovely lady from California.
She flew specifically from California to Wichita, Kansas, because that was the closest we were going to get to California. And so she flew all that way just to meet us.
And nice.
As a costume, which is pretty cool.
And it was, and the thing that she just stared at us like,
really?
Are you serious? And I said, yeah, sure. Come over. We're going downstairs to the hotel. We're going to have dinner. I assume you eat. And that's something we genuinely is just hanging out with fans. And
it's always nice to feel a little appreciated. Because writers don't get out very much.
We don't.
We don't. Closeted creatures. Like, we were at the Steam World, World Steam Expo.
No, close.
Where were we?
The Steampunk World's Fair.
We were at the Steampunk World's Fair. That's right, in Piscataway, New Jersey.
That's it.
And somebody, Puck,
came around the corner
and they just had a conniption when they saw us, and we didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
You talk
about fangirl. She just imploded. And staring at her, and we said, well, here's the James Fair, and she was like, that's not supposed to go up until next week. And we were like, yeah,
but we have it
here. And she said, how much? And she's scrambling for her wallet. How much is it? I said, well, we were told to give them away. It's free. Trevor takes the book out of her hands and there we go. Do you want to sign it? Which was that. Hi, and I said, sure. And as we're signing it, she suddenly takes a breath and she just went, oh, I forgot my copies of Spectre and Geist. And then she suddenly starts staring like cussing like a sailor. Like, surreal bad experience we've ever had here.
But it was fun.
It was fun. So yeah, we
generally, nice to surprise people.
Yeah, we always
surprise. We're here.
Another we enjoy doing at the cons are a live podcast. You know, just firing up mics and just recording our panels. Sometimes that can be a lot of fun.
One of my coworkers at the place where I'm doing temp work right now, he's also a podcaster. I believe his blog is called The Ramblings of a Distracted Writer. I was telling him about this, and he's, oh, I saw them at Dragon Con. I stood behind them, but I didn't say anything.
Well, I mean, people, a lot of people said, oh, you know, we're always like, come up and say hi, and we love doing that sort of stuff. It makes us feel like we're actually reaching people stuff.
Yeah, reaching people that we don't know. Yeah.
That we don't know. It's not our parents.
Yeah, they're
not. So, yeah, we're doing quite a few conventions this year already.
Yeah, we have an AcroCon coming up in February.
That's in Atlanta.
And then we have, I believe it's in March, we have Maticon at my alma mater, at JMU.
Yeah, we're going to be at the Frederick Book Festival.
We're
going to
be at the
Frederick
Book Festival. We're guests at the Industrial Revolution
in New Hampshire.
That's in New Hampshire.
Oh.
Nashua, New Hampshire.
And we're going to be at Dragon Con this year.
And we are going to be at Dragon Con this year. We are definitely going to be at Dragon Con this year.
Oh, and Authors After Dark in Savannah, Georgia.
Authors After Dark in very balmy Savannah, Georgia.
We're going to be in Atlanta and Georgia a lot.
I know. Yeah, we are.
Never thought of that.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Maybe by then they'll have more chargers when we can take Joan down with us.
So what does your mom think of steampunk?
My dad is trying. He's trying to get through it. And What he has to keep telling himself is, it's just like the Wild Wild West. It's just like the Wild West. Because that was one of his favorite shows on television, was you know, the classic Wild Wild West. Mm-hmm. And when he read in the steampunk Bible that was grandfathered in, he was like, I get it. I understand what it is now. But he seems to be having a tough time with it. I'm not sure exactly. Well, it's one of those books. My father is the kind of reader in the same way he's kind of he's kind of like when he watches television, he likes to do work like paperwork and reports and things like that while the television is on. So one time he tried watching 24 while doing doing some figures, and he stops and he's like, whoa, what the hell is going on? And so he tracks with the show, then he looks down, does some more figures and crunches numbers, looks up and he goes, wait, who is that? And where the hell, what? And I said, yeah, Dad, you have to pay attention. And he says to me, and I quote, I don't like doing that. And I'm like, I'm doing that myself. Yes, you do, and it drives me nuts.
Well, I think my dad knows what steampunk is because he's a big old genre geek.
But reading is the same way with my dad. My dad likes the spoon-fed, you know, stuff like the David Baldacci stuff, the Dan Brown, you know, the stuff that if you miss like a word or two here, he'll rehash it in the next chapter. You know, that kind of we basically put it out there, and if you're not paying attention. I remember hearing people say that about our book in a review somewhere. It might have been on Goodreads. But on Goodreads, they were like, yeah, I tried reading this book, and it's really – I couldn't skim the chapters. I had to actually, you know
– Read it.
Read it. And I'm like, they did. You know, I mean, we
– So you actually have to read books? What kind of BS hobby is this?
Yeah, really.
You have to – attention. It's not like the Lord of the Rings where you can jump 25 pages and go, oh, okay, they're still walking. Great. Yeah.
But now you don't have the full context and history of where they're walking. You may as well just start over from the beginning.
But yes,
we are quiet.
Now sometimes my audio goes out, so I can't always tell. I think I've gone through all my questions. Although when you were talking about movies before in the Avengers, I did want to say that I just saw Beasts of the Southern Wild, which I'd never heard of, but since it was nominated left and right, I actually thought I stumbled upon it on Redbox and rented it, and what a lovely movie that was. An odd movie, but a lovely movie. That was it.
Well, so I think we're running out of steam.
Yeah.
You can shank me for that one later, Sam.
I will.
I walked into that. But do you have any other upcoming projects you want to just shill, get that bell working a little?
Oh, well, what have we got?
We can talk about it.
Pip, when is Kindred and Wings coming out? Because I really, really liked the first book in that series.
I'll do my separate and we finish the ministry. I have the Kindred and Wings coming out in Harbinger, the last of the Order of the Deacon is July.
The last book featuring abortion and raid and terror.
Is also July, so it's busy. And also an anthology I've got called The Clockwork Fairy Tales is coming out also in the summer. And then the ministry stuff I've got going on this year is Galileo Games is developing the ministry into a role-playing game based on the Fate system. And we're going to start talking about that, which is probably going to happen in March.
In March.
But at the same time.
We're going to be doing a project of not only the game, so kickstarting an anthology. Because we... there's a gap between the Bear and Dawn's Early Light. So to bridge the gap, and that is to bridge the gap between Janus of Air and Dawn's Early Light with a digital anthology with a possible limited print run depending on the success of the Kickstarter. And we're going to independently produce it, and it's called the working title is Tales from the Archives Declassified. And it is a anthology. It will not be podcast. And it features right now we've got Thumbs Up from Tracy Hickman to appear in it. Liana
Hebler.
We've got Tiffany Trent. We've got Jack Mangan. We've got
Alex White.
And we will, if there's room for us, we will be in there as well.
Well, we're going to be in there.
Yeah. Well, we're going to be editing it.
We're going to be in there.
Okay, we're going to be in there. This is going to be the bridge between the two books.
It's going to be our big ministry project this month.
Yeah,
this
because unfortunately we weren't able to get the paperwork and everything in time, and we want to make sure that we don't lose the momentum. So we will be working on getting the anthology and this role-playing game from Galileo Games out, hopefully by the end of the summer, maybe by the winter.
There you go. Well, I'm always excited for anything with Fate in it. I might just be a giant Fred Hicks fanboy.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it. We're heading in February up to Pennsylvania to hang out with the delightful J.R. Blackwell and P.J. Schneider, who we are working with on that project, and I think it's going to be awesome.
We're going to sit down, we're going to hammer out a few ideas, and we're going to see what happens.
Very good. And let me just apologize for my Skype-ness. Apparently now I've learned I am not the one to ever start the phone calls here.
Okay. Oh, you live in...
There we go. We live, we learn, and while we're shilling things, you still have probably about a week to vote on the next round of books for the book club. Let's see if we can maybe, get something really weird on there.
I would like one of my picks to be there, please.
Well, right now we've got three definites and a few and a handful of... Someone please vote for this again so I don't have to, flip coins to decide which of these gets cut from the final six.
Redemption and Indigo.
No, I want to do a Clockwork Orange.
It disturbs me how much violence comes up as a major theme in the books we pick. I'm just throwing that out there.
I enjoyed the book when I read it as a teenager and it stuck with me. Whether that's something I should share with people or not, I don't know.
Yeah, you might want to keep that for your inside voice.
All right, so okay. If that's all we've got,
yes.
I bid you all good evening.
Thank you, Tina and Pip. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thoroughly enjoyed this.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
You guys have a wonderful evening.
Okay, thank you too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Bye. Good night, everybody.
Backseat Book Club is a Backseat production. Visit backseatproducers.com for more shows. Join the discussion and make suggestions for books on goodreads.com. Music by Kevin MacLeod.